Hello, you're listening to Wine Blast, and you are very welcome. Whether you're brand new to the pod or a long-time listener, or indeed anything in between, the more the merrier as far as we're concerned, and particularly with this podcast. So thank you for joining us.
Well said. Welcome, everyone. Wine is always better in company, so here's to sharing the love. But actually, on the subject of long-term listeners, this episode is the direct result of a suggestion from a regular listener, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. Yeah. So David Dowling wrote in a little while ago, and we won't say how long it's taken us to get around to this, but we always aim to get there in the end, which is the important thing.
We get there in the end.
We do. Anyway, David admits to being a bit obsessed with orange wine, and he wrote, "Thank you for the podcast. It's a pleasure and so informative."
Ah, flattery will get you everywhere, David. Love it.
"Please, can you do an episode on orange wine?" We fell in love with it at the fantastic Terroir restaurant, now sadly closed. "I agree with John Werdemann that orange wine is the perfect pairing for food. It can start chilled and fresh with the starter, but then warm perfectly to accompany the main course, and even sweeten with the dessert. I also agree that it is not just hipster wine, although I do live in North London and love those Hackney restaurants. You should think about featuring the wines on the Italian-Slovenian border. Radicon and Gravner are some of the finest wines in the world."
There we go. Thank you, David. We should say that we featured Georgian wine producer John Werdemann of Pheasant's Tears, who makes natural and orange wine, in our Georgia for Ukraine episode in 2022, just to explain that one. And Terroir, for anyone who doesn't know, was a fantastic new wave London wine bar and restaurant focused on natural and orange wine, which closed a few years back now, I think, about 2021.
Maybe just a bit before its time.
We enjoyed that immensely,
yeah,
we did, didn't we?
Anyway, so thank you, David. Thanks very much for the, I would say, very welcome suggestion to cover orange wine, which is a fascinating subject. It's very topical, much misunderstood, somewhat controversial, not to mention an intriguing story, you know, featuring a wine style lost in the mists of time being resurrected painfully and painstakingly by a handful of brave pioneers, but which is now going global.
It's all a bit Indiana Jones, isn't it? And then a bit Back to the Future, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised if it starts going a bit The Hobbit, you know, maybe Gandalf's going to rock up at some stage.
We are not
Anything
going
could happen here.
No. You're going to say Simpsons in a minute, aren't you? No.
I was working towards it.
And then I am definitely going to stop you.
You nipped that in the bud. Oh, shame. Anyway, you know, you're right. This is a hot topic, isn't it? And we are going to get right to the heart of the matter, interviewing the key players in orange wine, including the iconic producers David suggested, and ultimately asking the critical question, is orange wine actually any good? Here's a taster of what's coming up.
Just because you start with white grapes doesn't mean you need to end up with something that looks like supermarket Pinot Grigio. There's a whole world of possibilities, and they're much broader and more varied than we ever thought.
Wine should be a pleasure. If it's not a pleasure, then it's better not to drink. We don't have all to do the same. We don't have all to use the same grapes. Different region, different wines, different people. It's a much bigger richness than being all the producers making the same thing.
You cannot help but be struck by something which looks just so amazing in the glass. It was as if the molecular structure or nature of my tongue had been rearranged.
Orange wines will stay on the map forever.
So respectively there, Simon Wolfe, Matteo Gravner, Doug Regg and Sasha Radicon, all of whom we'll be hearing from in due course. Now, we should add at this stage that we got so excited about orange wine that we've ended up making not just one episode, but an orange wine two-parter.
There you go. We're over-delivering, David, already. this is just such a big and fascinating subject. We definitely needed two episodes to do it justice.
Yeah.
So this is the first instalment. And we should probably kick off with just throwing our tuppence into the ring on the matter, shouldn't we?
It would be rude not to, wouldn't it?
What do we think?
Yeah, so orange wine. Just by way of quick clarification, we're not talking about wines from the orange region in Australia. Sorry to any Aussie fans. Nor are these wines made from oranges. That would be just wrong.
I think Simon Wolfe had a good line on this. He wrote, "Orange wines aren't made from oranges. any more than rosé wines are made from roses. And I quite like that. That was a nice...
Yeah, it's good. Right. It's good. So yeah, orange wines. Orange wines are white wines, but made like red wines. So they're white wines with skin contact. And believe it or not, that's not about the winemaker diving naked into the ferment.
Shame.
Maybe not. Anyway, most modern white wines are made by using just the juice pressed out of wine grapes and fermented. The skins are thrown away. With orange wines, the skins are kept in the juice, macerating.
And that's why you say they're white wines made like red wines. Exactly. That maceration with the skins.
Exactly. So red wines aren't red because of the juice, because the juice is red. Actually, the juice itself is sort of pale or a bit greyish. Yeah. Red wines are red because the juice is kept in contact with the dark-coloured grape skins and the pigment leaches out of the skins.
And it's not just the pigment or the colour, is it? But it's also other things like flavours, texture, all kinds of stuff come out of the skins, you know, including compounds that make the wines more stable, so able to keep well over time.
Exactly, exactly.
Perhaps at a time we didn't have self-dioxide. Yeah.
And this was the traditional way of making wine, both red and white, for all those reasons. So orange wines, just to be clear, it's white wine where the grape skins are macerated with the juice for a period of time, and sometimes the stems too, actually. And now this can be a short time, it can be a pretty long time, depending on the results the winemaker wants to achieve. But what it does is give the wine a deeper colour, hence the name orange or amber wine. And this process, as you say, also gives some tannins, some extra texture and flavour, and an ability to age over time.
So really, we're talking about a different style or category of wine. And actually, Simon has described orange wine as the fourth colour. And when you put it like that, it does sort of make sense. So if you've got red, white and rosé, which we all accept happily, orange is the rightful, perhaps forgotten, fourth wine category. So that makes it all, you know, make sense. You know, but for a long while, it just wasn't on the mainstream wine radar.
And which is bonkers when you think about it, especially given it's one of the most historic wine styles around.
That's absolutely true. And I suppose it's interesting to think how traditions can easily get lost if they you know, fall out of favour, become unfashionable. Then maybe one, two generations don't learn about them. And they get forgotten about. Their place in the firmament, if you like, just gets lost. And by way of personal admission, I think we should say this, you know, orange wine certainly wasn't on our radar when we first came to wine and learnt about wine. So when it did, it was a bit unsettling. If we're really honest, you know, quite hard to get our heads around.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it just didn't fit into what we'd learnt wine was or could be. So it was a bit weird in that sense. And actually, to be fair, a few of the wines we tasted back then were properly weird in that they were basically faulty and pretty nasty.
You know,
overdone, over-oxidized, tannic, you know, really chewy kind of monsters of wines.
And this sort of tied in with the evolution of the natural wine scene, didn't it? You know, in terms of timing when it came along. And you know, there were some pretty nasty natural wines as well as the good ones. And there are good ones, but there were also a lot of horrible wines. But at the same time, it's important to distinguish between natural wine and orange wine.
That's true. So natural wine is a philosophical approach or essentially a point of principle.
Yeah, exactly. So natural wine is about low or minimal intervention across the whole winemaking process. So, you know, organic farming, no cultured yeast or other winemaking products, no fining, no filtering, minimal or no added sulfites, that kind of thing. But there is an overlap with orange wine in that they're both a sort of return to what might be called traditional values, you know, a move away from what might be termed ultra-modern winemaking with all the latest gizmos and technology and techniques, which kind of dominated in the latter part of the 20th century all over the world, and not just in wine, but across many different kinds of agriculture. But now we're starting to question that approach, and that's where natural and orange wine sort of come in, isn't it?
It is, and not all orange wine is natural wine, and certainly not all natural wine is orange wine. You know, natural wine can come in pretty much any style.
Exactly. Equally, it's important to pick up on what I was saying earlier. It's important to say that not all natural wines are faulty or overdone, and certainly not all orange wines are like that either. I mean, particularly now, when these categories have had a bit of time to evolve and mature a bit, there's just you know, I guess less dodgy wine selling by sole dint of its aspirations or philosophy now, the bad ones have tended to clean up their act or just fall by the wayside.
No, absolutely. I mean, very few these days are dodgy.
Well, you just can't get away with it.
And actually, we did cover natural wine, didn't we, back in 2022, and I'm sure we'll be coming back to it soon. But for now, we should, I think, return to orange wine and bring in our first guest. Simon Wolf was once a musician and sound engineer who toured with their bands, including psychedelic rock band Gong. He's now an award-winning wine writer based in Amsterdam and is the author of the magisterial book, which we love, Amber Revolution, How the World Learned to Love Orange Wine.
And stay tuned, because we have a very special offer on that brilliant book we will be sharing with you. Now, Simon is rightly considered one of the top global experts on orange wine. So I started with the deceptively simple question, what is orange wine?
Well, I'm going to give you the simplest possible definition, because I think people try to make this really, really complicated. Orange wine, to me at least, is just wine made from white grapes that have been fermented with the skins. Finished.
Very great. Brilliant. no need to overcomplicate these things, is there? Thank you. Could you perhaps plot, I think this is a good place to start, could you perhaps plot a very brief and rough timeline of orange wine to give a sense of the bigger picture?
Well, that's actually it's almost a trick question, because in a way orange wine is the oldest way of making wine that we know, if we talk about white grapes. I mean, if you don't have technology, if you don't have a wine press, if you don't have a stainless steel tank, if you don't have temperature control, you're making orange wine. So we can say with some certainty that Georgia, which is one of the oldest wine producing cultures that we know about, has an unbroken tradition of making this style of skin fermented white wine for around about 8,000 years, give or take. Maybe that, you know, that might seem like a slightly flippant answer. I think the key part of this timeline is that there is a big gap in it when this way of making wine went underground, basically. And there was a period, I think we can say roughly from after the Second World War until the 1990s, when people really didn't think this was what you're supposed to do with white grapes. They thought, okay, we're supposed to make this very sort of clean, bright, light-coloured thing that we all now call white wine. So there's a big gap there when this style just didn't exist anymore, really, or at least it didn't exist in a bottle. And when we started to see that reappearing was in the mid to late 90s in the north of Italy and Slovenia, and then it sort of gradually spread from there, really. And I think people rediscovered the whole idea in cultures where it had always been on the menu, such as Georgia, Portugal as well.
I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, so, you know, how did this sort of ancient Georgian wine style, or just ancient wine style, ultimately be resurrected on the sort of Italian-Slovenian border?
Well, I think what's important to remember is that although this style is most prevalent and maybe has the longest tradition that we know about in Georgia, it was the default way of making wine certainly all over Europe, probably all over the world at one point. So when you had people rediscovering this in the north of northeast Italy, western Slovenia as well, they weren't initially looking to Georgia. They were looking to what their grandparents had did. So in a way, we can say this, you know, this tradition has multiple touch points. It's deep in the culture of many winemaking traditions.
So it's just an ancient winemaking way of making white wine that's just being resurrected, being rediscovered and repurposed. I mean, in your book, your brilliant book, Amber Revolution, you describe orange wine as the world's oldest, most distinctive and most misunderstood wine style. Why?
I think it's misunderstood because in the modern era, we got so hung up on things like color, things like clarity. The whole of the professional kind of wine world really got this idea into its head that if you've got white grapes, then you shouldn't have tannins. You shouldn't have this structural component to the fore, really. And it's taken a long time. It's taken a few decades of winemakers being quite belligerent and saying, no, this really is something you should take seriously, to get that message across. I think that just because you start with white grapes doesn't mean you need to end up with something that looks like supermarket Pinot Grigio. There's a whole world of possibilities, and they're much broader and more varied than we ever thought.
I mean, you also say it's modern rediscovery caused incomprehension and uproar within the wine establishment. What kind of negative reactions are we talking about?
I mean, it was really quite strong when you had someone like Joschka Gorawna or Stanko Radikon, who I think we could say are probably the two big names if we're talking pioneers in Europe, in Italy. When they dared to go back to this way of winemaking that they're forebears had always done, they were already famous winemakers, and they sent out their new vintages, as they did every year, to their loyal clients, and they both got about half the orders sent straight back. You know, they literally had wine returned, and partly that was because they had negative press reaction. So that Gambaro Rosso did a famous article on Gravna when they said the brightest star has gone crazy, and people didn't even taste it. Yeah. You know, they just looked there. They took one look at the bottle. They took one look at the press reaction. They said, okay, it's the wrong color. It's the wrong aroma. It's the wrong taste. Send it back.
So people literally couldn't get their head around this orange wine style.
I think they couldn't. And the thing is, it's interesting how quickly this has happened. This is only really 25, 30 years ago that we're talking. You know, we're talking very end of the 1990s, beginning of the 2000s, when these styles of wine started to appear on shelves in a bottle, where previously it had just been a style that somebody would make at home and have for home consumption. So there really was nothing like this on the market. And I think it took people a while to get their head around this, you know, after decades of having it drummed into them that, okay, if white grapes were where we started, then it's not supposed to look like this, or it's not supposed to taste like this. So it took a while for people to reposition themselves, I think. I had an interesting conversation with Hugh Johnson about this. And I think he, like many, he sort of conflated the ideas of natural wine and orange wine. And we had a slight spat about it in the press some years ago. And I invited him to a tasting, and we tasted through a few wines. And he said, you know, Simon, he said, you know, this is the style that you would have got if you went to any sort of basic restaurant, any basic taverna, anywhere in the Mediterranean, and they were probably making the wine out back, and it would have been this color, it would have been this style. So he had a reference point for it. He just hadn't equated that with the idea of quality wine or the idea of fine wine.
Very interesting. And you mentioned natural wine there. I mean, you've written about a sort of lack of genre at the time for orange wine. It didn't exist, so people struggled to place it. You know, do you think the wine world needed to be in the right sort of headspace to accept orange wine? And that just took time. And it also took the natural wine movement to just shift the goalposts, as it were, change the nature of the game a bit.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think it's quite hard to pull those two concepts apart. I think natural wine and orange wine often seem to go hand in hand, because it's a very traditional style, and it's a style that we'd lost contact with. So I think, yeah, the natural wine movement certainly put that back on the menu. And in a way, you can say that orange wine, it's sort of the poster child for natural wine, because stylistically I think it's the biggest point of difference.
But yeah, you're very keen to differentiate between orange wine and natural wine.
Yeah, I think that, again, this is such a confusing thing for people, and I hear people muddle these up all the time, but I think the simplest way to put it is that natural wine is a philosophy. It's an overarching philosophy, and orange wine, to me, is just a winemaking technique. You know, we can talk about it being part of this, you know, paradigm shift and cultural traditions and all of that stuff, but ultimately, when you get down to brass tacks, it's just a treatment of white grapes.
Now, it's not been an easy task resurrecting this wine style in the face of popular opposition, as was. Can you tell us a bit about the pioneers of orange wine and what they went through and how they got on?
Absolutely. I mean, we already mentioned Gravner and Radikon, and I think we can talk about many of their colleagues in that little Slovenian diaspora, this little corner of northeastern Italy on the border with Slovenia. That's really the hot spot where I think people, they'd been in the shadow of French wine for decades, and there had always been this message of, if you want to make fine wine and be taken seriously, then you have to imitate the French. And then they were brave enough to say, no, actually, we've got our own thing going on here. We've got something that has much more resonance for us and where we're from and the grape varieties that we have. But yeah, it really took a while. I think we can say, in a way, it's still an ongoing process, but I think it took at least a decade before people really started taking them seriously. I think the interesting thing is, as well, if you look at the maximum resistance probably didn't come from consumers of the wine. The maximum resistance actually came from the wine trade, unfortunately, and even, you know, people like you or me. So I think that was the biggest hurdle to get across. You had people happily drinking the wine, and then you'd have people in the press saying, no, this is rubbish. Shouldn't be allowed. It's terrible.
Are we okay with the term orange wine these days?
I think it's a sensible term. You know, it's not, I didn't invent it. But as an observer, I look around and I see which term is in the most common usage. Orange wine has won hands down. And of course, there are people who complain and they say, no, we should call these skin contacts white wines, or we should call these amber wines. But I'm sorry, guys, that, you know, that ship has sailed. You know, orange wine is what most people call this, for better or for worse.
Now, orange wine is sometimes described, and you've described it as the fourth wine colour. Do you think it could replicate rosé's recent boom in popularity, or will it always be, you know, a relatively niche section of that spectrum?
I mean, it's interesting. It's getting less and less niche by the day. It's extraordinary, actually, when I compare the situation 10 years ago with now. It's quite extraordinary how many places, how many restaurants, cafes, wine bars you can walk into and there's an orange wine on the list. Oh, it's even by the glass. It's totally changed. Having said that, this is a style that has associations with low intervention wine. It's a style that has associations with very sort of handcrafted traditional styles. I think it will never have the commercial thrust of the Provençal rosé, and that's probably a good thing in some ways. Yeah, so I don't think it will be like rosé, but it's here to stay. You know, it's part of the furniture now.
There are a few more, let's say, commercially minded orange wine styles coming onto the market now. What do you make of those?
I think it's fine. I think there's room for everybody. I mean, there's usually a lot of tutting and R-ing when you have a major commercial winery dipping a toe into the orange wine pool. But I take it as a good sign, really. I think winemakers and wineries across the whole spectrum are interested and curious about this technique, and that can only be a good thing, really. And I think that's something else that's worth saying, is that there is not one style of orange wine any more than there is one style of red wine or one style of white wine. You know, orange wines can be light, playful, aromatic, soft textured, or they can be big tannic monsters and everything in between.
How would you describe the variety of orange wines today?
For me, the diversity is as great as it is in the worlds of red wine and white wine, maybe even as rosé as well. I mean, I'm not such an expert in rosé, but I think there is every bit as much diversity in the world of orange wine, and that is something that continues to keep me interested, really. You see winemakers getting comfortable with this technique and realizing there are so many ways that they can adapt it and integrate it into what they're doing.
What does the future hold for orange wine?
I think it just keeps building, really. I mean, it's interesting. I've been in China a couple of times this year, and there's a young Chinese audience for natural wine, which is building very fast now. And they are really in love with the style. So I think in China, in general, people have tended to prefer red wine. They've often tended to prefer something that's quite powerful and structured. And orange wine is the perfect bridge for that audience. It's the perfect way for Chinese consumers to relate to white wine, I think. So I'm seeing a real surge of interest there. You just see more and more winemakers really who are fascinated with the technique. And I think with winemakers, it's normal. You know, they're always, most of them are quite playful, really. They're always looking for something new to try. So I just continue to see more take up of the technique. I think more awareness of how you can use it in a sophisticated way. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. So I hope, really, and this has always been my hope, that we'll get to a point where orange wine is on parity with white, red, and rosé, where we no longer have this feeling of it being a ghetto or whatever, that we can just talk about all four categories together. That would be my hope.
Simon, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, orange wine on parity with red, white, and rosé. Don't see why not. But I think realistically it will take time and a lot more winemakers focusing on making really good orange wine all around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think Simon's right. You know, we are seeing that now. We're starting to see that now. Maybe that's your point. You know, you've got good orange wines coming out of, I don't know, everywhere. You know, the deep south of Chile, New Zealand, Canada, Georgia, of course, you know,
Greece,
Lebanon, England. We've tasted quite a few recently, haven't we? And we had one from Ukraine on our episode on that too. So they are popping up.
And hopefully, as we say, there'll be fewer and fewer dodgy ones as time goes on too, which is definitely happening.
Absolutely.
And obviously, in terms of quantity as well, there just need to be more orange wines being made if they're going to be considered as equals to red, white, and rosé.
So absolutely fair, absolutely fair. But in terms of the dodgy ones, let's not forget there are plenty of pretty crap whites, reds, and rosés as well. So it's unfair to single out orange wine just for that criticism. And what Simon told me about why he got into orange wine in the first place was that it was just so different and dynamic and full of life. He called it sensory overload. But at the same time, people in the wine trade were calling it emperor's new clothes, you know, and actually laughing at him. This is what he told me, for supporting it and saying things like, you don't really drink that stuff, do you?
And he still talks about it being an ongoing process, doesn't he? So very topical, I'd say. Right. Time for a brief pause and recap before we taste a few wines and hear from Matteo Gravner of the legendary orange wine producer Gravner. By way of summary so far, orange wine is a historic wine style whereby a white wine is made like a red, in that the grape skins are fermented with the juice, giving extra colour, flavour and texture. It's a style that became almost fatally unfashionable in the late 20th century when the vogue was for modern, ultra-fresh whites. But it kept going in Georgia and was revived particularly prominently on the Italian-Slovenian borderlands in the late 1990s, provoking confusion, anger, and excitement.
And that evolution has been continuing ever since, albeit probably more positively of late. And that is the perfect note on which to bring in Matteo Gravner. Now, Matteo is a trained winemaker and the daughter of Joško Gravner, one of Italy's most famous winemakers, based in the extreme northeast of the country in a village called Oslavia in the Friuli Collio region, which borders Slovenia.
Now, Matteo is the public face of Gravner these days, and her son Gregor now works with Joško. But it was Joško who decided the future was orange in the mid-1990s. His family winery had made traditional wines, but when Joško came in the 1970s, he initially made modern wines with modern equipment, and to great critical acclaim, it has to be said.
Absolutely. But over time, Joško became disillusioned, and a trip to California in 1987 convinced him that what was needed in the wine world of the future were points of difference in a crowded market and wines with a sense of identity and authenticity.
We'll let Matteo take over the story at this point. I should preface this by mentioning that the Ribolla Gialla grape is a local speciality in this part of the world. It can make quite neutral wines without skins, but with skins, the flavour, texture and quality of the wines is transformed.
So the winery started in 1901, just a normal farm with fruits, some animals and wine, turned into wine in the mid and late 60s. And then when my father took over the work from my grandfather, he started producing in the so-called modern way. So he started introducing all the technology he learned at school was necessary to produce important and modern wines. So he started using the pneumatic press, filtration, and so on. In the early 80s, he started and was one of the first in Italy using small French barrels, so-called barriques, for white wines, with a very long aging in barriques. And what happened was that after a few years, the wines were become quite famous and often awarded. He wasn't satisfied with these wines. They were technically perfect, but he believed he lost the soul. So he started thinking what was wrong, what was not working, and what could he maybe change. So he started studying the history. He studied Plinio the Young, and he went back to the original or the really ancient way of producing wines, and he discovered the amphora. So he started first changing the vineyards. We moved to organic production, despite we are not certificated. We don't really believe in certifications, but if you don't have clean grapes, you can't use the wild grape. So he slowly started changing the vineyards, introducing in the vineyards trees, artificial nests for birds, ponds, in order to bring a very high biodiversity, not only with cover crop or things like this. And when we finally got clean grapes with no chemicals, he started thinking how to use the wild branch. And this was then his main work during the 90s. In 96, we had an incredible help from the meteo, because we lose the world production between June 19 and 20th. For two incredible hailstorms, we lose the 95% of the production. My father was very brave, because he decided not to buy grapes, not to buy wine. And he informed every single client that we are sorry, but there will not be vintage 96. With the few grapes we have been able to harvest, he made the taste about the fermentation. So there were the on the wall farm, the production was for just 4 barriques, so less than 1,000 liters of wine, which was fermented in 4 different ways. So 2 barriques were on the skins with, and the next 2 were without skins. So one was with the skins with selected yeast, the next one was again with the skins with no selected yeast, and the same thing without skins. When my father tasted the Ribolla fermented on the skins with no selected yeast, with no temperature control, he finally recognized and found back the taste of the Ribolla grape, because his concern was mainly about how can Ribolla, why is Ribolla wine not tasting like the Ribolla grape? Where and how do we miss this taste? Because if you think about an apple, if you think about another fruit, you should find the taste of the single fruit at the end in the recipe. This was what he was not able to find in the previously made Ribolla and even the other wines. Why Ribolla? Ribolla is the variety, it's a white variety, it's a very local variety, which is grown in Friuli, especially in Collio, since more than 1,000 years. And it's very, very adapted. And when in 96, my father has seen how this crazy fermenting taste worked, he had no doubt. He sold out all the stainless steel tanks we used until 95. He sold out most of the barriques, and the whole vintage 97 was then fermented on the skins. And he started this skin fermentation.
So this is a story of rediscovering roots and opportunity coming from adversity, because those 1996 frosts sounded brutal,
they
didn't they?
They did, didn't they? One word.
Anyway, I just want to jump in here because Matteo mentioned amphora, and this is an important part of the Gravener story.
Yeah, and are these amphora or are they quivery?
Well, that's the question. But tomato, tomato. Essentially, we're talking about the same thing. Yeah, you know, old school earthenware or clay jars used for winemaking. You are right, though. We're really talking about quivery here because Yoshko took his inspiration from the Georgian tradition of fermenting whites with skins in these large amphora, or quivery as they call them in Georgian. He got hold of his first amphora in 1997 and he immediately loved the results because it gave what Matteo describes as a slower, longer and more natural ferment.
And that's really important, isn't it?
Really important. But crucially, it allowed the wines to be kept longer on the skins because of that slow process.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, a more gentle but prolonged extraction, giving ultimately greater complexity to the wines.
So didn't Yoshko then sort of set off on this grand adventure to Georgia?
Well, he tried. He couldn't actually get a visa until 2000. And then even then, he had to go with his own armed guides. But he finally made it over and bought lots of quivery and got really excited about being able to use them for the 2000 vintage. But the delivery truck unfortunately arrived too late.
We've all been there, haven't we?
It was after the end of the vintage.
That's not good,
that wasn't all, you know, how he kept going, you know, out of 11 quivery that he'd ordered and arrived, 9 were totally smashed.
See, I'd have given up at that stage.
I think we all might. I think that maybe says something about
I'd have called my delivery company and just.
It says something about your
show. It just sounds ill fated, doesn't it?
You know? It does. But he got there in the end, you know, by the 2001 vintage. It was partially fermented in amphora or quivery. And by 2005, all the wines were being fermented and made in quivery, and the reds as well from 2006. Matteo also said that they had to adjust the élevage process after this change to quivery. And the first year they really nailed it and got it right was with the 2007 vintage, which they bottled in 2014 and released in 2015.
So the 2007 vintage was the first one they kind of got all the process
spot on. They felt they got it spot on.
Interesting. You know, and we're talking about orange wines with 8 years of élevage before release. You know, I think Bordeaux should be blushing at this point when they're trying to sell it as quickly as possible.
We must not forget is that this switch from modern whites to orange amphora wines was a huge gamble. You know, Yoshko was called a madman in the press. He had wines returned, as Simon explained. Anyway, but let's hear a bit more about all this from Matteo.
He was really sad because he couldn't understand how could they not see what he was doing. For Yoshko, it was difficult to understand how was this that they were not able to see the path he was starting to go on. From the other side, I understand this all these people, because Yoshko never told what he was doing, and he just produced a different wine, and not only a different wine, but a completely different style. Only in 2004, a name, a definition for this kind of wine was starting to use. Orange wines, this category of wine had absolutely no name until 2004. So selling something which had no name, which was very far from other taste, wines they were not always perfectly clean, not really light yellow with some green color inside. This was something most of people were absolutely not able to approach. And he started thinking that technology is something very important, progress is very important, but for things we introduce in ourselves, which means we drink and we eat, we have to go back to the origin. Then less processed food, less processed wine, all these things started to be important to him, because he decided his Ribolla has to taste like the Ribolla grape. And if he's not able to transmit this, there was no sense in producing wine, and there was mainly not sense producing Ribolla. So this long work was just to do this. The problem was that the market was not used to this taste, because no one ever had it.
Matteo, can I ask, if we fast forward to sort of now, what does the use of amphora and the Ribolla Gialla grape, what flavours are we talking about and textures? What would I get in a glass of Gravna wine?
Ribolla remind on an apricot, ripe peach, can have tea leaves. So it's very, very complex. It's not a, how to say, a flat wine. And this was what he wanted to show in the glass, because in his opinion, in his mind, this was possible. And he made it. So amphora allowed the becoming wine to stay on the skin as long the wine decide, which means we have very different fermentation times in every single vintage.
So why do you think, Matteo, that orange wines have become so popular?
I think there are many reasons. One was that probably a part of the market started being bored. We almost lose the consciousness about our taste, what we taste, what we like. And a certain part of the market, especially young people, started saying, okay, but I prefer another one. It's not only about 100 points. It's not only about Trebicchieri. This was one reason. Another reason was, I think, a little bit more concerned about producers. Producing in this way, if you don't have to buy a lot of technology, think about a pneumatic press, filter, and all these engines, they are necessary to produce. If you reduce the financial limit, you allowed many more people to start producing in this way. So the good part was a lot of newcomers and a lot of new wines. The bad part was that a part of these producers were not aware how to produce wine. So some wines were very difficult to approach, especially at the beginning. Nowadays, I see and I think that there is much more the natural wine movement or production is much more consistent and the average quality is much higher than it was 10 or 15 years ago. Will this be forever or not? I think that people, they really believe in this kind of production will preserve. Not all the varieties are supposed to work well. Not all the regions can have this kind of wines. But I think this is just the natural evolution. We don't have all to do the same. We don't have all to use the same grapes with different region, different wines, different people. It's a much bigger richness than being all the producers making the same thing. And this is even for customers. They can choose different things and hopefully find what they really like.
How do you feel about your winery's place in the history of both orange wine and also to an extent Oslavia?
I think that the important thing is how many people were influenced by my father's work and how many people felt brave enough to start their own work and being much more concerned about the environment, about good grapes, about good wine. And I think this is the most important about what my father made in his whole life. The other thing is we are a very small part of the world. Oslavia has maybe 300 people living here. We changed our passport many times, being part of the Slovenian minority living in Italy. I think that, again, accepting and preserving diversity is something we have to do, because not to say I'm the special one, but just together with other people, they are different, we can give richness to the world instead of being supposed to be a limit just because our mother tongue is not Italian or another one. So let's think this for everything, not only humans, nature, everything. Diversity is always better than being all the same.
Matteo, what does the future hold for orange wine and for Gravna?
I think that we are in a period the orange wines are pretty mature, so you can find few very, very good, some other they are following and I are finding their own path. And finally, what I see is that there is a decrease of stupidly used amphora, which means There are a lot of people, they try it. Some are preserving because they believe this is working well. Some other abandoned because they have seen this is not the best choice for their region, for their reproduction. And even from the other side, the customers are much more aware and they know and they approach the wine in a little bit more conscious way. So it's, I think, what we really needed with this kind of wines was to be a little bit more easygoing, because wine should be a pleasure. If it's not a pleasure, then it's better not to drink. And this is the future. We will preserve this. We are very concentrated about the local varieties. So we will only produce Ribolla and Pignolo for the future, trying to do every single year the best you can. So there is never a limit, a superior limit to quality. And every year we see that we made something wrong, we misunderstood, we are not able to follow the nature needed. So every year there is something to improve. And believe me, it's quite a hard work to do.
Matea, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So no resting on laurels, even from an iconic orange wine producer. And I should add that I also discussed with Matea how they're now experimenting with making their wine in glass jars, which is really neutral, like the amphora, but it might just allow the process to be sped up a bit.
Interesting. But essentially, Gravner, so I got this straight, is all about long-aged, amphora-matured orange wines, mostly orange wines, somewhere, but, you know, made with the local Ribolla Gialla grape in Oslavia.
Mm-hmm.
Is that about right?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. You know, maybe sort of inspired by the ancient ways of Georgia, but also inspired by the local traditions in the hills, you know, surrounding the Italian-Slovene border. Also with a restless focus on improvement and an evolution that sounds like it's still ongoing.
Yeah. Now, very sadly, Joshko's son Miha, who worked very closely alongside his father, he died in 2009. But Joshko also works with his daughters Matea and Jana, and now Matea's son Gregor too. So you do sense there's more to come from the Gravner family.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's nearly time to wrap up. Just before we do, we've got time to have a cheeky taste or two, have we?
Oh, very swiftly.
Okay, very quickly.
Fine, which is probably not something you should do with orange wine.
That's very true. It's probably going to give us indigestion or wind or something, isn't it? You know,
I hope not.
At our age, definitely not ideal for the constitution.
Move on.
Anyway, I'm thirsty. Let's move on. We've got two really good orange wines, orange wines
we're
in front of us.
We're looking at value here, aren't we?
First up is the Santa Teresa Insieme, I think, Orange 2022. This is about £15, isn't it? Which is about as good value as decent orange wine gets. And it's just really fun. It's upbeat, engaging in style. It's kind of a wine that makes a great introduction to the category.
Yeah.
It's juicy, fleshy, aromatic, and you do definitely get a touch of tannin, which I think is really important in orange wine. But it's not too scary. It's not too overdone. So it's just perfectly balanced by the fruit. You know, you could describe this as a more commercial style, but I think it's a rare one that actually works on both fronts. It gets the balance just right.
Yeah, and it's a blend of Inzolia and Zibibbo. Mm. It's from Sicily. Mm. And it's just really, I thought it was really sunny and attractive. Yeah. You know, very tasty, great value, as you say. Yeah. I agree.
No, love that. I love it.
Lovely.
I think it's great.
Now, I've got a wine here that I absolutely love. It's the Berger Estate Zelen 2022 from the Vipava Valley in Slovenia. It's a bit more expensive, $23.55 from Le Cave de Perenne. It's got 7 days skin contact. Again, not a full-on orange style.
So seven days, sometimes people can have months,
exactly,
can't they?
Exactly. And then I think it spends 7 months in concrete. But it, you know, it's quite subtle and elegant in terms of its texture.
Yeah.
But what it does have is this lovely, yeasty, bruised red apple rusticity. It's got so much character. It's so engaging. It's a little bit edgy, but not too much. Just different.
Yeah,
and
that's good.
I loved it. Delicious.
So we're not sure we're getting the pronunciation quite right there. It's the Burja, B-U-R-J-A, Zelen 2022. Who knows?
No idea.
Sorry
Don't
if it's wrong.
Slovenian.
Anyway, but it's really delicious. I completely
it's
agree.
Bad.
So we've got two brilliant value orange wines there by way of starters. In our next orange wine episode, we'll be recommending more and even Whisper It, Clashing Heads. over a particularly controversial and divisive orange wine.
Well, indeed.
We have been arguing over a fair amount already.
Yeah. But that's for next time, isn't it? So as we prepare to leave you on that cliffhanger, we should probably do a quick closing summary. Orange wine. Orange wine, or skin contact white, is a category with a long history, even if people had largely forgotten about it by the late 20th century. But pioneers like Joschko Gravner in Friuli braved the hostility and incredulity by starting to revive this ancient wine style from the late 1990s onwards. Nowadays, it's increasingly accepted as a bona fide fourth wine category after red, white and rosé. And yes, we do call it orange wine, whatever other people might say.
Yeah, on that note, I need to share a very hot discount code with you. If you'd like to get hold of Simon Wolfe's excellent book on orange wine, Amber Revolution, you can get 20% off by going to Simon's website, The Morning Claret, and entering the code, all capitals, BLASTP20. That's BLASTP20, all capitals. Or just use the link we'll put on our website show notes.
And that code is eligible until the 1st of March 2024. So get your skates on, lovely people. Mm. We highly recommend Simon's book. I've read it several times.
We do, many times. Join us next time to hear from natural wine guru Doug Regg and iconic producer Sasha Radikon. Plus, there'll be a bit of elegant argy-bargy, as I've already referred to, an explanation of my mysterious lamb litmus test for orange wine. Who knows? Plus, we will aim to settle the matter once and for all. Is orange wine really any good?
Until then, we'll say goodbye. Thanks to Simon Wolfe and Matteo Gravner, and thanks to you for listening. Cheers.